So for those of you who haven't been here for the last few Sundays, I am in the middle of doing a series of talks on the topic of the five hindrances. And today's topic is the second hindrance, which is, in Pali, the word is vyapada. And it's often translated into English as aversion, but it literally means ill will. Sometimes I've even seen it translated, maybe a little bit exaggerated, but translated as hate or hostility, but ill will. And so that's the topic for today, good old ill will. What do you think of that? Come to Sunday morning and we're going to talk about ill will. The hindrances are those things which obstruct the capacity of the heart or the mind to be free, to be luminous, to be present. There tend to be those forces of the mind that keep us preoccupied and lost in the preoccupations, or in some way obstruct or obscure our ability to be present. And I think that almost any spiritual discipline of any kind of religion has to, in some way or other, deal with these obstructing factors of the mind. They might not have the same list, but somehow they're organized or categorized different ways. But the tremendous forces of the mind that take us away from being present, from being engaged in what we want to do with our lives, our intention, have to somehow be addressed and overcome or resolved or do something with. The hindrances relate to a very interesting topic, which is, where do we put our attention and where do we put our intention? Where do we invest our attention? And why do we choose to put our attention in certain directions, certain places, opposed to other places? So when we get caught up in, for example, desire, sensual desire, why do we choose to do that? Or why is that operating for us? Why is our attention, our intention, our thoughts going into the world of sensual desire, or into the world of ill will or hostility? And to really begin looking, you know, why is it our mind operates the way it does? Why do our thoughts go in certain directions? And not to leave it as a given, and not to leave it as something which can be unexamined or something to be justified, but rather we look at it as something to be investigated and understood. In the Buddhist tradition, the five hindrances can be seen as kind of doors. If those doors are closed, then the depth of Buddhist spirituality is not available to a person, or parts of the depths at least. And if those doors are open, or open means that if those hindrances are not present, then a person can step through through that door. And what's on the other side of that door is a huge world. I was going to use the word a mansion. I don't know if that's a good one, but a huge world. And I know some people who don't know anything about meditation might think, oh, meditation must be boring. You sit down and you close your eyes and you get calm and that's it, you know, as opposed to this whole world that you can do. You can go on hikes and you can go to movies and you can go you know, hang out with friends and you could, you know, go to baseball games or whatever. You can do all this stuff. It must be very interesting. The world's really interesting, but sitting, closing your eyes and being calm, I mean, it's good for a little while, but that's not, you know, it's not enrich. And it turns out that that once you step through the doors of the hindrances and enter this world that's available, it's a much bigger world than the world of our usual experience of life, going around living our lives and relationships. And so the meditative dimension or the inner dimension of life, there's a lot of different states, experiences, aspects of our psyche that then can be investigated and explored. And for the most part, all those are really good, really wonderful aspect of human life. Some people would call it sacred dimensions. Some people would call it liberating dimensions of life, healing dimensions of life. But if those doors are closed, then there's very little access to this deeper part of our lives. Some people feel that they have a great longing for what's on the other side of those doors. They feel a calling or a longing, or they really want to, they feel maybe some intuition that this is where they can really feel at home. And it makes some sense because the hindrances are forces of the mind which make it very hard to feel at home in life or with ourselves or in ourselves. The first two hindrances, desire, sensual desire and ill will, tend to fragment us, tend to kind of alienate ourselves from ourselves. We don't really get to know each other very well. It's very hard to be settled on oneself if one's in the grip of desire. Because usually desire sends a person out of themselves. Even though you might feel the desire is inside, there's usually an object of desire which we're preoccupied with. Ill will often also has an object that we're focusing on. And whenever we have an object that tension or thoughts are interested in, there can be the possibility, the tendency, of then losing touch with the subject, the subjective sense of what it's like to be present for ourselves. So if I'm consumed with, you know, wanting to buy a television and getting the best television, I might not pay attention to actually what it feels like to be in the grips of that desire and what it feels like. And that's part of the danger of the hindrances, is when they're operating quite strongly, we tend to lose a certain level of self-awareness and self-control because of that lack of awareness. So the first two hindrances are sensual desire and ill will. And today's topic is ill will. But they're kind of pairs. They have to do with relationships we have with objects. We either want them, we want more sensual desire or comfort, or we might kind of have ill will towards it. Ill will is defined in tradition, this Vayapada, as a desire to want to strike out at the object, come and hit it and push it away, or, you know, somehow. Some act of hostility. I think it's important to see that the Buddha was often very careful with the words he chose. And the word here is ill will, vyapada. Here in America, a lot of Dharma teachers, including myself, will expand the definition or the meaning of these hindrances to include other kind of broader dimensions of forces within us. So it's very common, I've done this, to call the second hindrance the hindrance of aversion. And I think a lot of aversion has ill will in it. But not all aversion has ill will. I can imagine there's some healthy aversion. Healthy kind of turning away. Aversion means to turn away. So, no, I'm not going to do that, to turn away. There's no hostility towards what you're focusing on, but no, I don't have to do that. I sometimes have a healthy form of aversion to driving up Highway 101. And I choose 280. I don't hate 101. I don't have no hostility towards it. It's a fine freeway. I'm very glad it's there. But it just seems like not a useful thing for me to drive that freeway that often. So I kind of turn away from it and take 280. Is that aversion? Is it wisdom? Or is it desire for something good? Is it desire for something better, more healthy, or 280? You know, sometimes you can't always tell the difference between, you know, aversion and desire are kind of like sometimes two sides of the same coin. And it depends, you know, what side of the coin you're talking about. The same thing with anger. Is all anger a symptom of ill will or not? If there's hostility, then it's hard to justify anger. But is there forms of anger that don't have hostility as part of it, or ill will? And that's for you to decide. That's not the topic for today. But I think the Buddha was focusing more on this issue of ill will. And ill will, you know, just striking out or a kind of hostility to our experience, has a lot of consequences for us. One is that it's painful. It kind of cramps up the mind or the heart, kind of constricts things. Things get kind of tight, sometimes kind of brittle. They sometimes predispose the eyes to look for what is undesirable in the object that we're paying attention to. So, you know, if people have a lot of ill will, they're carrying kind of a... they're disposed to having ill will, then it's easy to kind of pick up all the things in an environment which are somehow not right. And it's really easy to look around and find out the things which are not right and shouldn't be this way. I mean, I just noticed that I have a hole in my sock. I mean, so, you know, there's various objects of hostility, you know. I could be hostile towards my sock. This shouldn't be. The universe shouldn't be made this way. I could have aversion towards myself. How could I have not paid enough attention? How could I have aversion to, you know, the sock maker. I could be embarrassed being here, and in my embarrassment, I could have aversion to all of you. You know, because if that's one symptom of ill will sometimes, is to cover over embarrassment or awkwardness or whatever. So, you know, I could probably look at all of you and figure out something about each of your clothes. That, you know, that it'd be really kind of, you know, how could they come to IMC wearing that? Wow. You know, and but I don't, my mind doesn't work that way. I'm just talking this way, so making a point. So some people have it kind of as their disposition, as their kind of attitude or approach to life, is to kind of, for whatever reason, to look at what's wrong or what's off, and then to have a certain hostility or ill will towards that. In extreme forms, it can lead to a very alienated life. People can feel very isolated, very withdrawn, kind of difficult to connect. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You have aversion to people, and then if people react then to your aversion. People see what's wrong with people, and then people kind of act, you know, they feel uncomfortable around you, so they kind of dismiss you, and then they're not really present. It proves the fact that everyone is bad. There's a different kind of result in life if we have a predisposition towards seeing the good in people. And then people respond in a different kind of way. That's a different kind of self-fulfilling prophecy when we see the goodness in people. In a Buddhist meditative approach, we're trying not to have a particular disposition of how we see things, but we're trying to train the mind to see things as they actually are. So not to have a filter over our views. And if there's goodness, to see the goodness. If there's badness, to see it. But without having hostility or without having desire. I think of desire, especially sensual desire. See, it's very easy when we talk about these first two hindrances to slip away from the actual words the Buddha used, sensual desire and ill will, to talking about desire and aversion. I just find myself kind of slipping in there all the time. So I'll just leave you be responsible for, you know, dealing with that. I'll do my best, but... desire and aversion, desire and ill will, often I call it the caffeine of the soul. Some people depend on desire and aversion to keep their energy level up, their enthusiasm for life, their engagement and stuff. And it's very, some people don't understand how to get themselves revved up or how to be engaged in the way unless they have these forms of caffeine. And some people, when they stop taking desire and aversion, they feel kind of flat or bored or afraid or lonely, or, you know, it's kind of like the difficulties of their life begin to show. And they just kind of go through withdrawal periods sometimes. Some people don't know what a natural energized way of being is because they're always depending on this kind of high or this push that comes from having the thoughts churning away desire or churning away about ill will and all the emotions that come from that. I think part of the reason why some people love ill will or hostility is that it's very energizing. And some people love that energy. Occasionally, ill will and hostility, hate, is something that creates community. And so people love the community that comes from them. You can have wonderful conversations with people about how terrible certain people are, certain politicians, for example. And you feel a certain kind of, you know, camaraderie because, oh yeah, they understand and they're kind of like, yes. And part of the what's going on in the conversation is the sense of connectedness that comes from shared hostility. So it's the nature of hostility or ill will to somehow not let us see clearly what's going on. It tends to color things over. It's also the nature of hostility to tends to alienate ourselves from ourselves. It's hard to really pay careful attention if we're in the grips of ill will. This becomes more and more important when a person's engaged in a meditation practice. Because something which is mild tendency to be caught by desire or caught by ill will in normal life that becomes seemingly really big in meditation practice. Or say it a different way, the more It's kind of like the present moment is a razor's edge. And the more closely you can be on the razor's edge, the more we're sensitive to even small movements of desire and ill will take us away from the present moment. To really have a clear, full, open door to the present moment, we can't have any of these desire and ill will. Desire and ill will can't be there to close that door, can't be there to kind of push us off the edge. So one of the tasks of meditation is to certainly begin becoming very familiar with the forces of ill will and sensual desire so that they don't have to derail us, so we can stay present. And that's not always so easy. But the first task is to certainly recognize when ill will is present. And when ill will is present, then to be willing to shift where our attention, our intention, and our focus is. When there's ill will present, we have to be willing to shift our focus. Without that willingness, it's really hard to continue with the mindfulness of ill will coming into the present moment. So what I mean with this is that if I have ill will towards my sock, and I'm focusing on that, and that's what's going on, I'm churning out thoughts of ill will towards my socks, and I really feel justified in my hate to my sock because there's a hole in it, that I have to be willing to shift my attention away from the sock to be present for what's actually happening for me, to explore and study ill will, my hostility in my own being. And that's not always easy to do because sometimes the preoccupation with ill will is a form of protection. I have to kind of really have these thoughts so I can take care of myself. Sometimes there's tremendous attachment to ill will because it relates to our sense of self-image, who we tend to be, who we are. Sometimes we feel really hurt. Ill will is there because someone has hurt us. And if you're really justified in having ill will, if we let go of the ill will, then it's kind of like, then I've condoned the person or let the person's getting away with something. I have to keep my ill will because otherwise, you know, the person's getting away with something. There's many reasons why people stay attached to ill will and stay in its grip. And part of the process of learning to shift the focus away from the ill will, the object of ill will, is to investigate and understand the beliefs, the beliefs we have about why we should be engaged in ill will. Why we should stay there thinking those thoughts. So a lot of self-understanding has to happen. I think it's a close enough quote I've heard a few times now. Someone has said, the price of freedom is forgiveness. I thought it was a nice quote. I don't know if it's always true. But if forgiveness is an issue, if a person has resentment, forgiveness is only an issue if you have resentment. Otherwise, if you don't have resentment, I don't know if you need to forgive particularly. But if there's resentment or held anger or held hostility, then forgiveness, some form of forgiveness, some form of letting go or giving up that hostility or that resentment is required in order to become free. You can't be free if you're still clinging to something. The cost of freedom is to learn to let go of ill will or the grip of it or the attachment to it. It might still arise, but can it arise without us being attached to it? And are we willing to pay that price? And I suspect that there are plenty of people who are unwilling to pay the price of letting go of their ill will. Or in certain circumstances, unwilling. I've known, I've been in the grip of ill will at times. And, you know, logically, rationally, I know that it's not good for me, it's good to let go of it. But somehow my deeper psyche is kind of really into it, really attached to it, and I don't want to let go of it. So then it takes a lot more investigation, a lot more bringing attention to what's going on. So the first thing is to recognize it's there, and then to begin to shift the focus in some way, to change the context of how we're present for this, how we're present for what's going on. And one of the ways of talking about this is to turn the attention away from the object and to be present for the subjective state of what's actually happening. And then to explore that, get to know that. Know it better. And then to stay present for it, getting to know it and stay present until we see that it passes away, fades away. It's very encouraging, it's very empowering to track something like ill will or desire from its beginning, its middle, and its end. To see that it's arising, or at some one point be able to recognize it, and then to have it there in the middle and understand its different aspects of it, to be present for it, explore it, investigate it, shift the focus of attention, and then at some point watch it fade away. One of the reasons why it's very encouraging is to realize we have the ability to ride it out. We don't have to kind of be pushed around by it. But we can just kind of stay present, stay balanced, stay composed, and not be hooked by it, not act because of it, and just watch it to the end. And I know that sometimes with both desire and ill will, there can be tremendous arguments. It's happened in my mind. All the pros and cons, all these voices of why I should have these desires, or why they're okay, or why I should have this ill will, why, you know, I need to have it, why it's important. And all these voices come up. So it's very important then to investigate and engage those voices so we don't believe them or act impulsively because those voices are there. And occasionally for me in my life, my engagement with desire and ill will has been could qualify as a wrestling match. You know, it's quite intense, the forces and power of these things. And to me to wrestle with this and kind of, you know, because, you know, the grip, the way I've been held by them, and this voices inside of me, or the kind of the arguments inside of me and the emotions that were connected to it, were really, really strong. And luckily, you know, I had enough wisdom to know that I shouldn't act on this. But even then, it was, you know, kind of a wrestling match. So sometimes they're very subtle, and sometimes they're quite intense, our engagement with these kinds of obstructions to our luminous presence, to our ability to into this world, of the spiritual world, which is so big. If I think the more a person has a sense, intuitive or experiential sense, of the huge world that's possible when we step through the doors of the hindrances, we keep those doors open, the less we're willing to pay the price of being in the grips of these hindrances. And I know many people who said they really paid attention to their anger, and they realized what a tremendous cost it was to be angry. And why should I pay such a high price? It affects, you know, my well-being, my health, my heart. People have gotten heart attacks and died when they get angry enough. So they realize the cost. Oh, it's not worth it. And I think the more sensitive a person becomes, the less they're willing to pay the cost of being in the grips of ill will and strong sensual desire. So part of mindfulness practice then has to be a willingness to stop and look at forces of ill will when they arise. And then how we hold the ill will is very important. Again, shifting the context of how we're present for these things. And one of the changes has to be, hopefully, is not to have ill will towards our ill will. Not to be hostile towards our hostility. And that's not always so easy. I've known people, I've had it, who have a tremendous aversion, tremendous hostility towards their tendency to be hostile. And it can be devastating for people. The sense of self-criticism, hostility towards oneself because of these tendencies that we have. It can add to the sense of alienation, isolation, being oppressed, being trapped. It's a feeling that people have when they're very strong grip of hostility or ill will. So to begin exploring, how can we have a healthier relationship to this? An accepting one, or a spacious one, or a peaceful one, or a non-conflictive one, non-violent relationship, just to see it and hold it there. And that's one of the very powerful aspects of mindfulness practice, is the aspect of having non-reactive awareness to our experience, to non-reactive awareness to our ill will. get to know it, explore it, hold it. Be willing. It takes sometimes a lot of bravery to be able to hold something like ill will with an acceptance or non-reactive awareness. One of the antidotes for ill will in the Buddhist tradition is cultivating loving kindness. And when our relationship to ill will, our relationship is so in the grips of ill will that it's not productive, not useful, we can't bring up a kind of non-reactive awareness, then it's very helpful to switch over and cultivate loving kindness, to develop loving kindness, to do loving kindness meditation, which is a whole very important meditation practice in the Buddhist tradition. And then once the loving kindness, the sense of friendliness is there, then perhaps to go back into that area of ill will and explore it in a different way. As we explore the ill will, there's a number of things that we might discover that are useful. One is that ill will is sometimes a covering for something deeper. The Pali word for a hindrance, nivarana, literally means a covering, so something that covers over. So what is it covering over? And sometimes ill will, hostility, can cover over frustrated desire. A person has a lot of attachments, but they're not being fulfilled. And that pain, that suffering of frustration, can play itself out in ill will. Sometimes ill will is a cover for fear or embarrassment. And sometimes we strike out when we're uncomfortable as a way of protecting ourselves. And it's often not very useful, but it's a kind of a strategy of how to protect ourselves and make the situation okay. So as we stay present, we can be kind of looking underneath this cover. What are the forces that are pushing or giving fuel or energy to the ill will being there? One aspect of mindfulness of ill will is mindfulness of thinking, of thoughts. To be the observer of our own thoughts. And to look at the thoughts go by and see the kind of nature, the quality of those thoughts. Oh, hostility, wanting to cause harm. And then there's the way of paying attention to it in the body. And this is also a very important aspect of mindfulness practice. And that is to drop into the body and feel what the ill will feels like physically. If it's very strong, it'll be very clear what it feels like. If it's very mild, very subtle, maybe it won't be so clear. But to drop down and feel the energetics of ill will in the body. Feel where you feel, maybe feel tight, constricted, where the impulse to strike out is, where the intensity of fire might be. To look and feel in the body what's going on. And then to let the body be the container for those feelings, those sensations. I often have the feeling that my emotional life can sometimes, especially in the kind of unwholesome emotions, are often located in different parts of my body. And if I feel them in my body and then open to let the whole body be the container for that, so kind of there's a bigger container than the particular location, then there's kind of space and there's more kind of sense of freedom in the midst of having the more unhelpful emotional experience. So to drop down and learn how to use the body to stay present. Last thing I think I want to say, and it has to do with an aspect of mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is paying attention to what's happening while it's happening. Notice what's happening in the present moment while we're doing it. And there's a lot of things in the present moment we could pay attention to, but it's often useful to kind of really notice well what is most compelling, what's most predominant. So this morning I was making pancakes for breakfast, and I loved it because I was just, you know, present for opening the cabinet door, and I felt what it felt like to open the cabinet door. I was present for taking the box, these boxes that we sometimes use. Not yet today wasn't box pancakes. No, today I made what we call my family scratch pancakes. So I was feeling, you know, the different sensations and being present for the different experiences. And I can see the tendency of my mind to pass over the present moment very quickly, get into my thoughts. But in order to practice mindfulness, I was just there for each thing in and of itself. Each day for cracking the egg, for scooping out the sugar, for being there with a frying pan. My mind wants to go off. It has important things to take care of, like figure out a talk. And so I'll come back and just be here for this. It was really lovely to kind of just be present in the simplicity of what it's like to be making these pancakes for my family. And then at some, you know, there can be kind of a sense of a flow, just staying in the flow of the present moment, just being in the present moment as things are going on. Ill will and desire are forces that take us out of that flow. And the trick is, how do we stay connected to the present moment in a way that's useful, so we don't get derailed and leave the flow. And so we have to be wise about how we're affected by ill will and by desire. And one of the ways to do that is to stay in the flow of the present moment, to have a dedication to being present, practicing the mindfulness. If you stay in the present moment, stay in the present moment, stay in the present moment, and then notice what is it that takes you out of it. Sooner or later, you're going to have to become a student of desire and ill will, because those will pull you out of the present moment, out of that flow of just being here for this, being here for that. The hindrances, ill will and sensual desire, are what human minds are kind of tend to do. So it's best not to take these as personal failings. Every human mind has strong forces of desire, strong forces of ill will, or has a tendency to those things. And just see it that, oh, here, the universal, universal aspect of human life has appeared for me. I have ill will. That's very different than saying, oh, shit. How am I? I'm such a lousy person. I have hostility. And that approach of, oh, here it is, a universal aspect of human life. I get to study this and learn how to be free of it, is so much more helpful than some of the more self-critical ways we can hold these things. So those are my thoughts about ill will. I hope it encourages more goodwill. But what are your thoughts about this? Do you have any comments you'd like to make, or questions, or?
What about when you're in the presence? I can't tell if it's on or off. All right. What about being in the presence of someone who seems to be compulsively involved with ill will, and your witnessing of it doesn't seem to affect things, and it can just go on and on and on?
Well, I suppose sometimes witnessing is not the appropriate thing. I've been the recipient of very strong ill will, and I've said, you know, this doesn't work for me. If you don't stop, I'm going to leave. And the person stopped. You know, you can make boundaries. Sometimes you have to make boundaries and say, this is not acceptable. And that's what's required. I mean, sometimes witnessing someone's hostility is not medicine. In a sense, it can just let the person, you know, have free rein to kind of...
I don't mean not necessarily toward me, but just expressing ill will toward other people or other situations.
Why do you feel responsible for that person?
Just how to act, you know, appropriately in the situation, or you're suggesting just stopping, just leaving the situation.
It can be. It's such an abstraction, your example, that it's hard to know what the right call is in that. And I can just give various possibilities. There certainly are times when the appropriate thing would be to simply remove oneself from the situation. This is not helpful for anybody, and I don't need to be part of it. Sometimes it's helpful to speak up and say, you know, this is not acceptable, and I don't think you can keep expressing all this hostility. Even in the world around you, and that's the right call. Sometimes it's to recognize maybe the person's suffering and say, you know, somehow get under the radar of the hostility and kind of touch their suffering and, like, say to them, you know, I think you're having a hard time, aren't you, today? Or to say, you know, I've noticed that you're expressing a lot of hostility, and maybe it'd be useful if you just kind of vented a little bit with me. How about if you just vent for a while? And if you give them, you know, clear permission to vent, venting is not exactly, you're not really caught when you're venting as much as you're doing it without, because you're more conscious then. You're bringing a certain level of consciousness to it. So you can do the person a favor and say, let's, you know, I realize there's lots going on. Let's vent it and see if we can kind of, there's a lot of, I can't, you know. Or what do other people think about this issue? What if you're present with someone who's a very hostile person, hostility is not necessarily towards you, and what are some of the options you have, what to do? So you can simply say how you're feeling, and you can say, I feel uncomfortable with all the hostility. Yes?
Well, another possibility is kind of along the lines of your idea of getting under the hostility to the suffering. So you could, instead of... So one option, as you said, is to say, what would you like to vent? And then another option would be to say, this is tricky because, you know, when you lay a diagnosis on someone, if it doesn't fit, it doesn't feel good to them, but, you know, sounds to me like it was really painful, your interaction with this department chair or whatever it was. I bet that really was tough. You know, how did that feel
yeah.
to you when it
happened? Something that tries to get them talking more about their feelings, which might bring them a little more in the present moment of what's underneath it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Another one way that something that works sometimes is to say something nice about them. Oh, you know. The other day you really helped me. It was really great the way you were helpful for me. And sometimes that can change the context. See, if you can see the beauty in the person who's being hostile. And there are some people who specialize, some friends of mine who specialize in always trying to look for the beauty in the other people. They actually look very carefully. They always, and then they try to reflect it back at the person. And so that's, you know, can sometimes work. Other ideas? It's only a couple of people in the room have had this experience, so.
I think distraction is sometimes very helpful, just as you indicated with comments. Creatively come up with to kind of derail their, you know, pointed exploration, I guess. And that, I think that requires a little bit more sense of what might be appropriate to say in that circumstance. But you know what I'm kind of going for? Because I know when sometimes my mind gets on a roll, if Steve can come home and just say, hi, honey, how are you doing? I have to, you know, there's a, oh. you know, am I going to come out of this or am I going to, you know, keep going? So I'm just saying that there's a slight shift that you might be able to help another person find, but it takes a lot of intuition, skill, and compassion.
It's also, you know, it's a very tricky thing to start taking responsibility for how someone else is. And someone who has a lot of hostility, if they pick up, they pick up the idea that you're trying to change them, I mean, watch out. And so there are times, certainly, where it's appropriate, and if you're really wise, you can do things, various things, that are helpful for the situation, maybe diffuse their hostility or their anger, whatever it might be. But I think that my hope is the first area of responsibility we take is for ourselves. And so to be really clear about how we're responding and relating to the person's hostility. Are we afraid? Are we angry? Does it relate to our sense of identity, self-image? And do we have a self-image of ourselves as a savior and we're going to fix it? Or you know, how are we relating to it? And so the first place is to really protect ourselves from our own unhealthy responses to that situation. And then once we're clear about that, and maybe come to some sense of being, some sense of balance or some sense of health around it, then maybe we can more wisely decide what to do in relationship to that person. It's not a black and white thing, you know, self, paying attention to oneself versus taking care of the situation outside. But I think it's very helpful to have a very strong habit of checking in with oneself and taking responsibility for our reactivity in all circumstances, yeah.
Yeah,
is it?
Doesn't seem to be working.
Maybe the batteries?
It says it's on.
Says it's on? Yeah. If you close it closer, hold it closer to your mouth, yeah.
In relationship to someone, not like a casual relationship,
yeah,
but someone in a family where you can't walk away, I would have a question about when there's a very hostile, a person whose habit is hostility. And it almost feels as if being in a poisonous situation. But it's also not helpful to walk away because it's a family member. And I am still, after years, I am just stumped because it's been a waiting game sometimes, just waiting it out.
Yeah.
But I've never said I feel poisoned because that feels unhelpful.
Can be unhelpful. It's very hard to know what to do. Sometimes being really honest makes things worse. Sometimes being honest makes things better, makes it the very thing they need to do. And there's always, I think it's often some risk of how to, because we can't really know what's going to result. There's often sometimes some risk involved. But if we can be clear about our intention, that's why taking care of ourselves first is really important. If we're clear that our intention is not to cause harm or make problems or then it reduces the risk level to some degree. The other thing is that some people find that a lot of benefit from cultivating and expressing goodwill, loving kindness to people who are hostile and are people they've been in intense relationship over. So for example, giving someone a gift, you know, showing up to this very difficult person and say, you know, here, I bought you something. Or, I'd really like to take you out for coffee. Would you like to come with me? You actually be proactive in being generous and being kind. And sometimes that can diffuse things. I've been told by some people that once they started including a difficult person in their loving kindness meditation, somehow, in some unseen way, they attributed that loving kindness meditation to healing that relationship. So there's many answers to these kinds of questions. I don't have one answer, but the last one, Scott.
I think it can be very important not to cling to the outcome, because you can try all these different things and sometimes it's just not going to work. And that can be very difficult to deal with, especially with a family member, but you just have to learn how to be okay with that.
Yep. So learn to be okay with that. again, to have the capacity and the ability to be at home or at peace with whatever difficulty might be around you. The hindrances are in part, at times, a unhealthy responses to feeling discomfort. And so one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to help us find the place to be non-reactive in the presence of discomfort. Some people would say to be at home or be at peace in uncomfortable situations. And that provides a person with tremendous power, because then you can go into very difficult situations and you know that you're not going to be reactive in that situation. So. She said, that takes a lot of work. And no one said that this practice is... We have to be very respectful of the tremendous power of the human mind and learning how to cultivate and refine the human mind can take a lot of work, a lot of time. I've heard it takes at least a lifetime. So I think it's healthy and helpful to think of it that way, that we're never finished. It's always something we're engaged in, and hopefully we feel the joy and the real joy of having a practice and having the possibility of cultivating and developing the heart. It's such a beautiful thing to do with human life. So we should stop, otherwise some of you will have ill will. Captive audience. So thank you very much. And next week we'll continue with the hindrances.